Welcome to the Canteen Podcast, a show for anyone who has feelings about food. Join host Ali Houston as guests open up about their relationship with food and their thoughts on nutrition. Nourish yourself with the Canteen Podcast.
Hey everyone, welcome to this episode of the Canteen Podcast. I'm your host Ali Houston. Our guest today is Dr. Asim Malhotra. He's a cardiologist and best-selling author whose book, The Pioppi Diet, helped Deputy Labour Party leader Tom Watson lose more than 7 stones. We talk about statins, climate change, patient advocacy, and much more, including why Asim should now be known as the Sherlock Holmes of medicine. I hope you enjoy. Please don't forget to jump over to iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts and hit that subscribe button. And please don't forget to leave a 5-star rating and review to get the podcast in front of more eyes. This podcast is made possible thanks to paleocanteen.co.uk, which is my company. Paleocanteen.co.uk is the UK's one-stop paleo and low-carb food provider, where you can get restaurant-quality meals, grass-fed Scottish beef and lamb, outdoor bred pork, and a selection of paleo and low-carb products delivered chilled to your door. That's paleocanteen.co.uk. Use the code CANTEEN15, that's CANTEEN15, to get 15% off your first order. Thanks, and enjoy the show. Okay, and we're recording. And we're lucky enough to have with us today Dr. Asim Malhotra, who is a cardiologist, a best-selling author of the book The Pioppi Diet. He's a researcher and a professor of evidence-based medicine. Welcome.
Hi, Ali.
Thanks for coming on.
My pleasure, mate.
So your book, The Pioppi Diet, is named after a village in Italy that you believe to have an extremely healthy diet. Can you talk about how the book came about?
Yeah, so basically, originally, myself and my co-author, Donal O'Neill, who'd done made a couple of documentary films prior to this, one called Serial Killers and the other one, Run on Fat, we connected. And I'd been a big advocate publicly of the benefits of the Mediterranean diet, really to try and put things in perspective that really what is the key to good health is having a good diet and not taking pills. And then when one looks at the evidence, and although nutritional science has lots of limitations and issues which are still ongoing, certainly the best available evidence we have at the moment does suggest that the Mediterranean diet, and I'll talk a bit more in detail about that, seems to be the best, has the best evidence for both preventing and managing heart disease. And obviously I come as a background, as a cardiologist who has spent, years looking into the root causes around the, burden of chronic disease, excess obesity in the population, et cetera. So I wanted to really dig deeper and try and find out, first of all, what is it about the Mediterranean diet that is beneficial? Which components of the Mediterranean diet, how does that fit with modern information that we have about how food affects health? And Pioppi, which is a village in southern Italy, interestingly, is a place where Ansel Keys, an American scientist who many people blame for being responsible for the epidemics of type 2 diabetes and obesity, where he spent much of his time doing research from. And this village is actually the traditional home of the Mediterranean diet. And Ansel Keys was responsible for changing dietary guidelines. His work had ended up with the demonization of eating fat and also cholesterol as a risk factor for heart disease. Certainly he contributed to that. And that changed dietary guidelines in the US in 1977, and the UK in 1983. So we went to this village, me and Donal, and initially made a film called The Big Fat Fix based upon how these villages live. Now, Pioppi's population is less than 200 people. Average life expectancy is 91. Many people live over the age of 100. But they age well. They have a very healthy, they have a good health span. So it's not that they're having lots of chronic disease for the last 10, 15 years of their life. They're all, very active and well. And with my interest in heart disease and the causes of heart disease and the management of heart disease, certainly I wanted to look at what were the lifestyle factors that were responsible for, their good health. And, something I looked into, obviously diet is a big component. It's about not being inactive, also about stress reduction, sense of community. So all these things together seemed to be coming out of this village, which wasn't a particularly affluent place, but certainly they seemed to have certainly an environment and a community and a behavior and a lifestyle that would help them live as healthy as long as possible. And that's how we basically wrote the book. Now, what we did is actually a better version, if you like, a more up-to-date version of the Mediterranean diet in terms of the health components of it. And when you look at the data and literature, certainly traditionally people associate the Mediterranean diet as being having a base of lots of starch, lots of pasta, lots of bread, you know, in other Mediterranean regions, rice, potatoes, that kind of thing. But actually, yes, I mean, in those countries, if you go back, traditionally they did have those foods, but they had them in small quantities. And they didn't snack, and actually it was actually the other things they were eating that were likely that what was benefiting them in terms of their health. So it was the extra virgin olive oil, it was nuts, it was oily fish, it was a mixture of veggies, it was, you know, different regions have more meat than others. So it was a nutritious diet, but it was also one that was anti-inflammatory. So the components of these food are, some of these foods are thought to be anti-inflammatory, and there's good studies and data, biological data on that. When you look at heart disease, Ali, the two biggest sort of twin risk factors, if you like, or at the root of heart disease is insulin resistance and inflammation. And insulin resistance, as you know, is essentially your body becoming resistant to the effects of the hormone insulin in the body over time. And different things contribute to that. But certainly in terms of diet, lots of sugar, refined carbohydrates, for example, excess body weight through whatever mechanism will cause chronic high insulin and can produce insulin resistance. And then you've got inflammation as well. And even it's not just heart disease, it's a precursor of type 2 diabetes. It's responsible probably for at least 50% of people's high blood pressure, of having high blood pressure. So for me, concentrating on those two things in terms of the hierarchy is the way to people having better health. And therefore the book was written for that purpose. But again, I must emphasize diet actually comes from the traditional Greek word diata, which means lifestyle. So diet is a big component, but it's other things as well which shouldn't be ignored when people want to improve their health.
Cool. And one of the people who've adopted the ways of the book and other healthy lifestyle adjustments is Tom Watson, the deputy leader of the opposition Labour Party here in the UK. He's lost about 100 pounds and cites the book as a big influence. How did your friendship come about?
Well, it's interesting. So I've in my last 7-8 years in my sort of work and activism, I've come across and met many politicians, people from all different parties, several people from the Labour Party, some Lib Dems, some Conservative Party members. I hadn't actually had much interaction with Tom Watson, although I'd met him at an event a few years ago, and he was very friendly with me. And this is actually before I'd written the book. So I think he was aware of all my activism work anyway. And then out of the blue, he just contacted me via Twitter 6 months in, I think, when he was following the diet. I didn't know that he was following the diet plan. I think some of it was probably also triggered by the fact that when the book was released, the chair of the all-party diabetes group, Keith Vaz, actually got up in Parliament and in a parliamentary session suggested that 100 MPs which had the highest prevalence of type 2 diabetes in their constituency, he actually challenged them to all go on a POPI diet over the summer to see how it would help them. Because of course, this, as you know, the obesity problem, people being overweight, is not restricted to any particular demographic or profession. I mean, it's all across the board. I mean, even 50% of NHS employees are overweight or obese. So, you know, he suggested they all go on the POPI diet. And I suspect Tom obviously must have picked up on it from that, potentially. He contacted me and said, listen, Nassim, I've lost, you know, I think you, at the time he'd lost over 50 pounds in 6 months or whatever. And he said, listen, it's going really well for me. I want to give it a bit more time to see how this goes. But, and I said, great. It was Christmas time, I remember, when he contacted me for the first time. And then, you know, several months later, he's on Good Morning Britain and he's come out and he's talking in The Guardian about the POPI diet and how this had helped him. So that's how we initially connected. That's how I connected with Tom. And, you know, he looks amazing. He's done really well. He's feeling good. You know, he's doing loads of activity now as well, which I think he would have struggled to do before when he was very overweight. So he's really in very good health because of that. And he managed to send his type 2 diabetes into remission. But I think rather than it just being an N equals one, I think we know, as you know, Ali, the data's there, it's quite strong that certain dietary changes have that impact. And I think the other thing we mentioned about POP diet, which I was well aware of as a doctor, which I think is very impactful and empowering for patients to know when I have conversations with them, is that these changes, the impact on health is quite rapid. It's not months and years. We know within a few weeks of people changing their diet plan, you know, you can improve your markers of cholesterol, your blood pressure, you can get your glucose improved, as well as losing weight. So the book actually was interestingly also, it was internationally released, and it was, you know, it was released in Holland towards the end of last year. And it was on the back of the fact that a very well-known, respected documentary health program called Doctors of Tomorrow decided to have an experiment where they asked me whether someone was going to take three people who have weight-related issues, one with heart disease, one type 2 diabetes, a lady who'd had gastric surgery and struggling with a weight. And you claim that your book, you know, your diet plan is going to help people get significantly better in 21 days. Let's test it out. I said, fine, it's N equals three, but fine. You know, I mean, I'm sure it should help them. And what I didn't predict is, you know, how dramatically it did, actually. The guy with type 2 diabetes, who was in his late 50s, you know, had it for 10, 15 years, managed to send his blood glucose into remission in less than a month. You know, the lady who had her weight problems, who struggled initially to come to terms with the fact that she was going to eat more fat than she was thinking that she was used to and lose weight, lost 10 kilograms wow. And felt really well. And the guy who had heart disease diagnosed recently was able to reduce his blood pressure pills and also send his blood glucose, improve his blood glucose as well. And these guys felt fantastic doing it. So when that was released in Holland, the next day the book came out. So when this documentary was aired, I think over 1 million people watched it. The book came out the next day and then went to number one in all books for the next 5 weeks in Holland until the Dutch Nutrition Council weighed in and suddenly started making claims which didn't really have any evidence, like, you know, Dr. Malhotra is recommending eating more than 10 eggs a week. That's dangerous. You know, high levels of saturated fat are dangerous, all this sort of nonsense. So, you know, it had an impact, clearly. And I think a lot of people have obviously benefited from it, which I'm really pleased about.
That's great. Picking back up on the Mediterranean diet, I've seen accusations of that you've hijacked the Mediterranean diet to push a so-called low-carb agenda. And I mean, in my opinion, this is kind of an incoherent slur. And I think that the term the Mediterranean diet is useful up to a point to describe a set of rough guidelines. But the problem is that your definition of the Mediterranean diet, so-called, is kind of different to the Mediterranean diet as defined by some other experts or health authorities who would tend to have it that, you know, that they would be starch based and grain based, and of course, you know, if you dig down, there's hundreds if not thousands of Mediterranean diets. Most of them are abundant in a variety of meat, fish, cheese. So the idea that limiting animal food intake is good because it's Mediterranean doesn't really hold true. But I mean, the other thing that has been pointed out recently by the likes of Zoe Harcombe and others is that if it's avoiding saturated fat that's driving people towards the sort of non-existent one and only Mediterranean diet, they're barking up the wrong tree, because olive oil has more saturated fat per 100 grams than steak. And olive oil is widely recommended by anyone recommending this so-called one and only Mediterranean diet. So it's a bit of a mess. I mean, why do you think there's sort of two camps using this term, the Mediterranean diet, differently? Why has that persisted?
I think there's a number of issues. So you're right about the saturated fat. I mean, I picked up on that a while back, that, you know, good extra virgin olive oil has anything from 14 to 20% saturated fat in it. Yet our guidelines are saying, you know, you shouldn't consume more than 10% of saturated fat. So some of this is misunderstanding of the science, Ali. And one thing I always advocate and try and explain even to my patients and the public and other doctors, you know, as a profession, medical science, I think, especially even nutrition, we need a bit more humility and less hubris. And I quote the founding father of the evidence-based medicine movement, David Sackett, Canadian epidemiologist, who said 50% of what you learn in medical school will turn out to be either outdated or dead wrong within 5 years of your graduation. The trouble is, nobody can tell you which half, So you have to learn on your own. So one of the things I would address these camps, I think some of it is intellectual conflicts of interest, people who aren't willing to accept that science evolves and look at up-to-date data and then change their mind because of it. I mean, that's part of being, as you know, it's part of being a good scientist, right? You know, and some of it's intellectual. And a lot of it is also financial vested interests. So, you know, the food industry have made a lot of money and profit from selling cheap carbs, you know, cheap processed carbohydrates. You know, and I think that's also another big component. And a lot of these people who have so-called eminence or are in so-called respected positions, you know, if you look at their funding sources or institutional funding sources, there's a lot of money coming from the food industry. There is an issue about the fact that, unfortunately, you know, the food industry has so much power that they've even influenced certainly our dietary guidelines. They influence politicians. You know, somebody very senior in Public Health England, who I met not so long ago, I mean, extremely senior, when I had a conversation with them about why is the Eat Well plate, which is our so-called, supposed to represent, you know, the best healthy diet, why is it ultra-processed foods on there at all? You know, why is there, you know, cakes and crisps and chocolates on there, in on the actual plate, the guide, if you like, to say eat this in small amounts, and the fact that several members of the people that made up the so-called Eat Well guide had, you know, were basically representatives of the food industry. This person's response to me was, Asim, you've got to understand the food industry is one of the biggest contributors to the GDP of our economy. So I said, well, hold on a minute, but your job in Public Health England is to reflect independent, best available scientific evidence, not to be appeasing or putting the interests of the food industry as part of that. So I think we've gone so far down the line that right now, as I've said, we've got an epidemic of misinformation, not just with diet, but certainly in terms of in medical practice as well. And we have to wind back from that. We've got the evidence and the science there. It's just about making sure that it's, you know, that it's pushed to the forefront when it comes to people getting information that is going to affect the whole of the population. So I think there's so many different things involved in that, Ali. And I'm not saying, you know, even from my perspective, things may change, and I will change my view, I'm sure, in terms of adjusting or thinking, well, you know, maybe this dietary plan, there is a better way. But up to now, all I can do is reflect the best available evidence in terms of what is going to be best for my patients. And this stuff works, and it has the evidence base. It's not when we actually has the evidence base behind it as well. Certainly in terms of refined carbohydrates, as you know, being the worst types of foods that are going to affect blood glucose in people who have type 2 diabetes, pre-diabetes, metabolic syndrome. And then you combine it with the fact that it has to be nutritious. People want to get all their nutritional, you know, requirements from it, and enjoyable. You know, it's not just because if it's to be sustain itself, It needs to be enjoyed. It has to be in keeping with, as I say, one of the components of evidence-based medicine to improve outcomes is patient preferences and values. So what does that individual person want to get? What do they enjoy? And some people may not like or enjoy low carb, and that's fine. But as long as they're given the information that they can follow the best possible dietary pattern for their health, and then they then make a decision on it, that's fine. You know, whether it's being, you know, vegetarian, you can be a healthy vegetarian. It's a bit more challenging to get your B12. But you can be a healthy vegetarian. It's much more challenging to be a healthy vegan, and certainly almost impossible to be a healthy vegan without taking supplements. You know, so all of this this sort of conversation, this is not being pushed to the mainstream. There's so many different agendas with people who, and certainly big businesses that have, you know, are there to profit and make a lot of money from misinforming people. And from my perspective as a doctor, that's completely unethical. It's wrong.
Mm. Yeah, it's interesting this... kind of, you know, what you said about the Public Health England representative who seemed to be taking the profits of food companies into account when creating, you know, health guidelines. I feel like it shouldn't be like that. And
I mean, to be honest, I don't think, you know, I believe in you know, democracy. I believe in informed choice. Do you think any member of the public, if they knew that, would find that acceptable? Every patient I've spoken to and said that to, they were shocked.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, the conflict of interest is such an interesting one. Like, I always think that when accusations get slung on social media about conflicts of interest, I always think that, yes, maybe they took money from this, that, or the other person, and it happens on all sides. And I think the main conflict of interest is the first one you mentioned, which is your own past opinions and the difficulty people have in climbing down from a position they've taken in the past, and saying, listen, I was wrong. That is, to me, the biggest conflict of interest. You know, you might be funded by a particular industry in your research, but I think it's harder to say I was wrong.
Yeah, I mean, that reminds me of a quote from the Canadian economist John Kenneth Galbraith. He said, faced with a choice between changing one's mind and proving there's no reason to do so, almost everybody gets busy on the proof.
Yeah. And it's borne out left, right, and center. And you end up with this kind of dug-in position on both sides and, I guess, sort of shouting matches and acolytes on both sides cheering their champion on. And we don't really get anywhere. I think there's people, probably the silent majority, are in the middle thinking, can we not have a decent conversation about what's actually happening? And so...
Yeah. I think you're right, Ali. And I think I know people have said this to me as well. You know, this is part of creating confusion. I mean, there is a battle going on, but you know, the battle is one of truth versus money, in my view. And for me, having understood and learned from the history, the lessons of tobacco control, you know, 50 years between the first links between smoking and lung cancer were published in scientific journals before any effective regulation that ultimately had the massive impact on population health were introduced. That it took 50 years. And the reason it took 50 years is because the industry adopted a corporate playbook strategy of planting doubt, confusing the public, you know, denial, and buying the loyalty of scientists. We've seen the food industry do exactly the same thing. So I'm fully aware of that. But for me, ultimately, yeah, I can put the information out there, but my ultimate goal is to help as many people as possible. So that, you know, for me, I came out of this wanting to change and help the healthcare system, which was under a lot of stress. So that's still my primary goal, mm-hmm. is that everybody can get the best healthcare. That's only going to happen if this information and right kind of regulations happen at the very top end. So everybody who may not have even heard of my work or who even know my name are going to benefit from this. And that means regulatory changes. And of course, at the initial, one of the first things I did was advocate for sugar reduction policies, which meant sugary drinks tax, and increasing public awareness about sugar. So that, you know, this principles in public health is addressing the availability, the affordability, and the acceptability of these products or foods or whatever else that are thought to be harmful. This is exactly what we use with smoking reduction. And these regulations, Ali, not education. I mean, there's a lot of social public health science on that anyway. It's regulations that have much bigger impact than education. So that everybody benefits, you know, and whether that means ultimately, you know, I've called for banning sale of junk food in hospitals. At the moment, we've got this problem where, you know, we're trying to talk about, have this conversation as a medical profession, yet we need to stop selling sickness in our own backyards. You know, until we do that, then we're not going to get very far. So these are the things that need to happen if we're really going to improve this on a population level. And in the meantime, yeah, we keep battling and people will benefit. And many of my patients and other people involved in this movement are going to have so many people following them that are going to follow their advice and they're benefiting. And I get all that feedback constantly through different mechanisms, social media, my patients, etc. But actually influencing the politicians in ensuring there are regulations also to stop these manipulations of the food industry. So that when people walk into a supermarket, they're not misled by buying a product which is, claims to be healthy and is an ultra-processed food and is going to have the exact opposite effect on their health. So that's really, for me, where my focus is primarily, as well as the other things I do, because I know that's where we're going to get the biggest bang for our buck if we're going to improve population health.
That makes sense to me. I'm actually, I follow this kind of debate very closely, because I'm aware that I have my own biases about what should be done and that there's a law of unintended consequences, so that, you know, you can call for a certain regulation and then not really know that there might be some negative impact of that in the future. However, I think if we stand back and wait for the information to disseminate itself, and then for individuals to start making informed choices, and then for companies to change their offering based purely on the demand of a well-informed customer, then you start talking like an economist who's not engaged with the sort of real politic of it and the human nature aspect of it. So that if you're not campaigning to the people who are regulating, and creating laws, then other people will be, because it is effective. And so the big companies are going to just budget, certain amount of money to pay for that. And they're also going to do the sort of the stuff that you were talking about, the corporate playbook stuff. Nowadays, it takes the form of, myriad articles in fancy magazines, online stuff. Seemingly amateur bloggers. It's called astroturfing, I think, where it just seems like it's natural grass growing, but if you look very closely, it's actually fake and it's paid for, and it happens all the time. And of course, it makes sense. Why wouldn't you? If you've, these are people who have high paying jobs, they've got families to feed, and they just want to think about how to maintain that. It makes total sense. And so if there's not people like yourself who are actively going up against that and saying to politicians, look, this is a disaster waiting to happen, not just because of the health of individuals at stake, but I mean, the cost to the UK of diabetes is outrageous.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's not just the health, it's a loss of economic productivity from the fact that people are going to be sicker for longer as well. So it's a lose-lose, really. You're absolutely right, Ali. No, it needs that kind of advocacy work. But at the same time, one of the things that I've certainly, become aware of and looking at over history about what happens during these times of so-called confusion or battle, happening, is that you will be attacked. That's one of the things that I have learned, that you will be attacked sometimes unrelentingly and viciously, and you'll be smeared and people will make things up. But it's just, there's part and parcel of this work, and you have to grow a thick skin. At times it can be upsetting, but to be honest, I'm like, well, actually, I take this as a compliment. The more you get attacked in these situations, the more impact you're having. So it's like, well, we're winning here. So, that's another aspect of all of this, which doesn't get talked about that much, but actually is a suggestion that progress is being made. I mean, the Sunday Times did an expose on the fact that when I wrote the PRP diet, I mean, one of the things I was doing a lot of private advocacy as well as public advocacy, and knowing this book was going to cause controversy, because I'd gone against the Eat Well Guide, gone against government guidelines, said cut out the starch, and follow a Mediterranean dietary pattern, but without the starch and sugar. As soon as it was released, there were, members of, most senior member of Public Health England, Duncan Selby, the chief executive, essentially they had contacted several, endorsees of the book who have a lot of authority and credibility, arguably the most important doctor in the UK, Professor Dame Sue Bailey, Andy Burnham, the former Secretary of State for Health and now the Mayor of Manchester, just a couple of people that were contacted, telling them essentially to dissociate themselves from the book and then create some negative press on it. Luckily, they stood firm. But the next thing that happened was, he called up the chief executive of a hospital that I was supposed to speak at, my local hospital where I grew up, where I was supposed to give a keynote talk about the, the evolution of the paradigm shift in heart disease. And obviously PRP diet was part of that for people to understand, about intermittent inflammation, essentially implying they shouldn't give me a platform. And certainly should not be associated with the book at all, and that chief executive got a little bit kind of scared off a little bit, because chief executive of Public Health England calling her up, the hospital chief executive. I have had other people, I won't name another hospital, a nurse that's been a big advocate of my book, who've been getting heart patients on the diet plan, being threatened essentially with loss of job. So people don't know this kind of stuff that's going on in the background, but we just have to keep fighting for really truth and transparency. I think that's ultimately what it's about. It's about, when given all the information, I always think about the consultation of the patient in front of me, that, evidence-based medicine isn't about dictating things. It's not about bullying patients taking medications or following a diet plan. It's about saying, listen, I'm an advocate for your health. This is why I do this job. And this is the main purpose for me, is to improve your health. as much as I can, give you the best possible opportunity for good health. That's why you're here. And that involves you making an informed choice as long as I give you all the relevant information in an unbiased fashion. Sadly, across the whole of the profession right now, that isn't happening because we are making clinical decisions on biased information. So really what we want to do, listen, it'll never be perfect, but we can do a lot better than we are doing at the moment when it comes to whether, you know, whether it's what dietary advice we give to patients or whether it's, you know, the drugs we prescribe as well.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And actually, statin drugs are often prescribed to people with heart disease. And you've said a fair bit about that recently, and a fair bit has been said back to you. What do you think about statin medication?
So I think statins as a cholesterol-lowering drug have traditionally had a role in the management of people with heart disease. But I think for me, again, it's about, you know, how effective are they? What are the downsides? What are the unintended consequences? You mentioned that earlier. And making sure patients are empowered with all that information so that they can reduce their risk and lead healthy lives. And again, based upon giving them the information in an honest and transparent way. People with heart disease, yes, statins do, certainly from clinical trials, there is a benefit. But even when you take those break those clinical trials down, which do have a caveat because they're selected patients, often people with side effects are taken out and not accounted for, then that benefit is still, for many people, quite underwhelming when you tell them that, you know, if you take a statin every day for 5 years, there's a 1 in 83 chance it will delay your death and 1 in 39 chance it'll prevent a recurrent heart attack in people with defined heart attack. A lot of people find that quite underwhelming. But actually, that's the most ethical way of explaining to a patient the benefits of that drug. The downside, if you don't do that and say, listen, just take this pill, you know, it'll save your life. And if you stop it, you know, you're going to die, which is often the kind of information that people receive, is not really evidence-based. I mean, the chances of that are extremely small. But also then that gives them, many patients, the illusion of protection. And then they think they can eat what they like. And there's data suggests that people end up more overweight and of a similar risk to take statins than people who don't, because of this so-called illusion of protection. But also, it's also a question of actually, is it unethical when we have information of a better way to tackle your cardiovascular disease risk through tackling insulin resistance? You know, we should be giving them that information as well. So you've got, well, listen, so what I do with my patients, Ali, is I say, listen, this is the absolute benefit. They say, doc, what else can I do? I talk through them all the different lifestyle aspects. I tell them, listen, there is a chance it might give you type 2 diabetes. I tell them about the side effects, but most cases they're reversible. And then they make an informed decision. For me personally, my personal opinion is that we should offer, not coerce, we should offer people with heart disease statins with the right information in a transparent way about the actual benefits and potential harms. And certainly if you haven't got heart disease, you're low risk, or you're elderly, I don't think they have any role whatsoever to play. I mean, it's a very, very small benefit, if that. And that's if you trust the industry-sponsored trials to be absolutely true, which I don't. I think there's a huge exaggeration and bias almost certainly in those. The problem is we are still making decisions about statins on non-transparent data. So while I advocate for giving people the information in a transparent way with the information we have already, at the same time, we should be fighting for, let's try and get to the bottom of actually how prevalent these side effects or how likely are they, you know, to develop in people in different groups. And for me, it's very clear. I've studied this in so much depth over many years, my clinical experience with patients, reading the literature, probably 30 to 40%, maybe more patients who take statins will at some point suffer a side effect, which is unacceptable to them in terms of their quality of life. And when you're mass prescribing a pill to the population saying this is the way to beat heart disease and this is the primary focus and you're ignoring other things, that's not just bad science, unethical.
Yeah.
And statins have not demonstrably reduced cardiovascular mortality in the population. And one of the reasons for that, Ali, as I've spoken in my talks, is that if you look at the data slightly differently and look at the statistics differently, then your median increase in life expectancy from taking a statin based upon industry-sponsored trials in people with heart disease over 5 years is just over 4 days. And when you consider many people are going to stop their statin in the real world because of side effects, you can understand why you don't see a demonstrable decrease in cardiovascular mortality in population. That doesn't mean some individuals won't benefit, But as a population approach, you know, the way that these has been handled, the vested interests involved, the fact that it's estimated by 2020, you know, total sales revenues from statins is estimated to reach $1 trillion. We cannot be naive to the fact that there are very, very powerful vested interests here who are putting marketing above the actual true science. So actually, we need a massive, you know, reduction in the amount of people taking statins. And I think we just focus on people with heart disease and then push the lifestyle factors with them and everybody else at the same time.
That makes a lot of sense to me. Yeah, I mean, my dad had been on statins for probably 10 years or so. He certainly suffered with a lot of problems that could have been potential side effects that weren't really picked up by his doctor. He just got given more medication. And, you know,
And patients are scared, Ali, as well, though, you see. They get unacceptable side effects. They carry on with them because they think they're going to drop dead. So they're going around with fear, unnecessary fear. You know, sorry, but yeah, this is another problem. And this is the experience I have on a day-to-day basis with patients.
Yes, it was kind of sad to see because, you know, I only really got to the science of it a few years ago and, you know, started reading up on the statistics like you were talking about there and relaying that to my dad. But, you know, of course, he's talking to a doctor and then, you know, so hearing information from me, it just doesn't compute. So, you know, I mean, I've heard you talk before about a similar thing with your mother and her vegetarian diet. You were quoted talking about that. Maybe you could talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. So, my mother died prematurely, age 68, towards the end of last year, having had quite a chronic debilitating illness with a combination of very severe osteoarthritis and rheumatoid. And, you know, for her, many of her health problems, certainly I attribute to, you know, for many years she had eaten, and she'd been vegetarian most of her life, but it wasn't the healthiest vegetarian diet. There was a lot of sugar involved. There was a lot of processed foods, a lot of snacking, a lot of refined carbohydrates. And I wanted to emphasize the point, especially in this era that we're in at the moment, there's a lot of health washing going on at the moment, Ali, around being vegan and vegetarian, all that kind of stuff. It's actually, well, not just take this as N equals one. What does the data tell us about being vegetarian and health? How does it affect what populations which have high prevalence of people who are vegetarian and how, what is their health like? India is the highest, you know, prevalence of type of vegetarians in the world. And they have the highest prevalence of type 2 diabetes. You know, it's not a coincidence that it's coming from the fact they're eating a lot of refined carbs and sugar. So ultimately, that's what I wanted to reflect in the article I wrote in the Eye, which had a lot of, I didn't expect it to have so much impact. I mean, it was picked up in the New York Post and it was being, you know, it was featured on the front page of the Eye and it had a lot of reach. I'm glad it got out there. But also to emphasize this issue about, you know, let's just be a little bit careful here. In terms of also the veganism and how it affects the environment and climate change, you know, it shouldn't distract us from other more important things that we should be, oil and gas industries that are contributing a lot more to climate change than a very debatable still discussion about whether reducing meat consumption will have that much impact on the environment. And even at best, it's very small, much smaller than what people think. So I think that's what I wanted to get across in the article. And certainly the other thing I mentioned as well, which is another, area of interest of mine as a doctor, that obesity is just a marker of a much bigger problem. The issue really is excess, much more likely to be excess body fat percentage, because many people up to 40% with a normal body mass index, again, given the illusion of protection that BMI is normal, have excess body fat and certainly will develop the same sorts of conditions that people with obesity are vulnerable to, whether it's type 2 diabetes, high blood pressure, heart disease. Again, it fits with my clinical experience as well. So it's really to emphasize that diet-related disease can affect all of us. It doesn't matter what your weight is. You know, we all need to be thinking about what we put into our mouths and how it affects our body, our hormones, our mental state, our sleep, and certainly our belly fat as well. So that was really what I wanted to put all these messages through that. And obviously from a very personal perspective, knowing and feeling that I genuinely believe if my mum's diet had been different and better, that she'd still be with us today, you know. And for me, she was just one of the most kindest, compassionate people I've ever known. I love, like, everyone loves their mum, but, you know, I really, had a lot of love and respect for her. But also understood why she was a vegetarian. And for her, it was purely from an ethical, it wasn't because of health reasons. It was an, for her, it was an ethical thing that, you know, she didn't want to eat animal flesh. And I understand why people are vegetarian. Most people are. In India, for example, you know, there is a perception that if you eat meat, you're a bad person. I think we need to understand where a lot of this movement is coming from. It's not about, you know, it's not about the environment. It's not about health. You know, a lot of it is coming almost from a religious, if you like, for some people, fanaticism perspective. I think that needs to be talked about a lot more, you know. And when I wrote this, I had a lot of support from various people, even many people who were vegetarians sent me. But I also got a lot of abuse sitting on my Facebook from people who are vegetarian who said that I was a very bad person, you know, for eating meat and all that kind of stuff. So it really drew out actually how some of these people are thinking. And I think we just need to understand that. And then we can have the debate on that level, not pretend it's something that it's not.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm kind of looking about and looking forward to getting someone on the podcast who, you know, lives in India and is steeped in this. And from what I've seen and read, there is a real religious fanaticism around not eating meat and ideas of purity and so on, and that it's a religious thing in a certain community, and that the people who have more resources in that community tend to eat the nutrient-rich vegetarian foods like ghee and eggs and paneer. And yeah, they insist that the people who don't have the resources stay vegetarian, which means just eating seed oils and chapati flour.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's a big problem, you know, as well. It needs to be addressed. And again, a lot of these people aren't made aware. I mean, they may not want to do it for specific their own personal religious reasons. It may be like the community or cultural thing attached to it. But they may be in a gray area, where actually if they're told, listen, you're going to get more nutrients, your child's going to get more nutrients from eating some meat, they would then make a different decision and try and eat meat as well. But yeah, so it's a big problem. It's a big issue in India in particular. That doesn't mean to say, as you know, you can't, you know, there are lots of people who eat meat and get type 2 diabetes. But as we know, the real issue is about the amount of starch, extra starch and sugar people are consuming. And yeah, toxic vegetable oils as well.
Mm-hmm. One last thing that I wanted to pick up on before we started recording, you were talking about your medical training and how you got your degree in Edinburgh. Your first job was in Wishaw, which is in the Central Belt in Scotland. And you had the odd night out in Glasgow as well. And, you know, maybe you were saying that you thought on some level, the medical training in Scotland was, I'll not put words in your mouth, but talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, so I went to Edinburgh Medical School. For me, actually, Ali, to be honest, it was a bit of a dream. I had offers from several different universities, the rest of them really in England. But actually, for me, Edinburgh was the top place. A traditional medical school, you know, one of the first medical school in Europe. Huge history attached to it, you know, a lot of famous alumni, whether it's Charles Darwin or Arthur Conan Doyle, who wrote Sherlock Holmes. I'll come back to that in a minute because there's an interesting link there between Sherlock Holmes and medicine and some of his insight. So yeah, I went to Edinburgh. It was a good course, traditional course, and I feel I learned a lot there that gave me a lot of, it taught me so much that I have learned and used as I've moved on throughout my career. In terms of also first principles of how medicine should be practiced, 80% of your diagnosis is taking the history. You rely on investigations and tests to confirm your diagnosis. Unfortunately, a lot of medicine, certainly in America, has gone down the other way, which is just bad practice, to be honest, in my view. So Edinburgh, I have a lot of fondness for. I had a good time in medical school there. And then for the first 6 months, my first house job as a junior doctor, in those days you did 6 months in medicine and 6 months in surgery, I worked in Wishaw General Hospital, which is, if I'm not wrong, the outskirts of Glasgow, isn't it? It's in that kind of sort of area. And it was a tremendous experience. It was a very busy job. It was the days where we used to do 12-hour night shifts, 7 days in a row, you know, so working 98 plus hours a week. I'm not saying that's we should go back to that necessarily, but you know, for me, it gave me a lot of. It was very empowering as a doctor to treat a lot of people. And as you know, in Scotland and in Glasgow and the out, you know, there's a lot of morbidity, a lot of cardiac morbidity, a lot of people dying prematurely of heart disease, a lot of alcohol excess. So you know, I was exposed to a lot of stuff, a lot of sick patients. You know, early on in my career, that gave me, I think, put me in sort of in a good position as a doctor early on to get good experience. But then I worked in vascular surgery in Edinburgh Royal Infirmary, and again, I'm dealing with type 2 diabetic patients who are getting amputation. You know, so I saw a lot of vascular disease very early on in my career, right at the coalface. I even remember, I'll never forget, actually being in theatre and having to, you know, assist the surgeon to chop off somebody's leg. You know, that was my first year as a junior doctor, age, what, 23? I'll never forget that, you know, that sound of that saw and thinking, wow, you know, why did this happen? And this guy was a type 2 diabetic and he smoked, you know, this was completely preventable. So that was my initial experience. And then I did 6 months in care of the elderly in Edinburgh as well, in a very exclusive care of the elderly hospital called Liberton Hospital, which was actually run by some of the most eminent, you know, geriatricians, care of the elderly doctors in the country. Again, amazing educational experience, partly because that taught me very quickly about the harms of over-medication. You know, still about 25% of people who admit to hospital who are elderly admit because of dangerous drug interactions. So often what we would be doing is actually taking elderly people off medications that had resulted in them being confused or falling or breaking a hip or whatever. So that, you know, it was a really good breadth of experience up there. And then I worked in many different places around the country, including Manchester Royal Infirmary, which had one of the busiest A&Es in the country, and I was 6 months there. So I was quite lucky and fortunate to be exposed to a real breadth of medicine before I then specialized in cardiology. Coming back to Edinburgh, I think one interesting thing that I was aware of, that Sherlock Holmes, everybody, many people know about Sherlock Holmes, the most famous detective, fictional detective in the world, written by Arthur Conan Doyle, who was a medical student in Edinburgh and qualified from Edinburgh Medical School. But one many people don't know is that Sherlock Holmes was modeled on one of his professors of medicine that Arthur Conan Doyle looked up to. And he would describe, I think, this doctor that he would sit in a clinic and he would see how somebody would walk through the door. And he would very quickly, almost, you know, just by looking at the patient, what they were wearing, what shoes they had on, whether there was dirt on their shoes, it would say which way they'd walk to get to the infirmary. And before the patient even opened their mouth, had already got all these clues to help make the diagnosis of what may be wrong at the very beginning. And actually something that we're taught, and I really enjoy as a doctor, almost a bit like solving puzzles. A lot of the time it's medical diagnosis is actually, is about solving a puzzle really, using information and then drawing a conclusion from that. And Sherlock Holmes's byline was actually, when you've eliminated the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth. And that's exactly actually how, in many ways, how we make medical diagnosis. And for me, in this process, in this journey of looking into the dietary guidelines, obesity, making sense of it all, using the information, you know, I use actually that principle to try and draw conclusions. And I teach my medical students the same thing. And they find it fascinating and saying, well, actually, when my medical students come in and I'm teaching medical students, says, do you know you're all detectives? And suddenly their eyes light up. I'm like, what are you talking about? And then explaining this story. So it just makes life a bit more interesting.
That's really fascinating. I had no idea that he went to Edinburgh Medical School or that he modeled Sherlock Holmes on one of his professors. That's amazing. And you picked up on an interesting point about taking older people off medications because of the bad interactions. And it makes me think about Peter Gutcher, who's written about prescription drugs being potentially the third biggest killer in the world. And it's a controversial statement, but he attributes a lot of those numbers to falls in the elderly. And, you know, it's obviously quite a hidden problem. And the other thing about, you know, your first experience of hearing, you know, the saw going through someone's diabetic limb being amputated, and an article in The Guardian the other day, talking about wounds and how the mortality rate for people who happen to have a wound that's not healing, most of which will be diabetic wounds, the 5-year mortality rate is 50%, which is way worse than breast cancer or prostate cancer, which are like 18% and 8% respectively, I think. I mean, this whole thing is just, it was a problem when you were at medical school. It's got even worse, and I think we need more. You don't need to be Sherlock Holmes to see that it's a massive issue. But I'm glad that there are Sherlock Holmeses like yourself doing the hard work.
No, mate, you're right. I think that's another thing you've hit on, a really important point there. This isn't about just preventing premature death. It's about quality of life. And people with type 2 diabetes, actually, some studies have suggested, surveys certainly, that up to 50% of people with type 2 will suffer chronic pain and depression, sleeplessness, at the same levels of people with terminal cancer. So this is about quality of life as well. And when you have type 2 diabetes, it's not just that your lifespan is, on average, can be shortened by anything from 5 to 15 years. It's about how you live with type 2 diabetes and how it affects the quality of life. Because ultimately, we're all going to die, you know, and most of the best that we can do as doctors actually is much of what we do is palliation, relieve suffering. This is about relieving suffering, if not more important than anything else that we do.
So where can people find out more about what you do? And I mean, I didn't pick it up because we've run out of time, but there's a few organizations that you're involved with that you might want to mention, like the King's Fund or Saving Londoners Lives. And, you know, where can people find you personally?
I mean, obviously I'm a clinical cardiologist, work for the NHS. I do also a bit of private work, but a lot of that's about shared decision-making, and people who are concerned about over-medication want to have a transparent conversation with me. And that's through, you know, you can find it on my website, drchristine.com, but it's called Rock Private Clinic. I see a lot of very interesting patients there as well, fascinating patients there. In fact, that's something I love, you know, one thing I love more than anything, I see patients. It's not just about helping them. I learn from my patients. Every single patient that I see, I take something from them that then gives me more information to help me with the next patient I see. So, I'm involved in the King's Fund. It's an independent health think tank that advises government health policy. I'm a trustee there, so I have a role as a trustee, and you know, in discussions about the direction of the fund, what we should be doing. I think they've been doing a lot of good work, certainly on public health, in value-based healthcare, the kind of things we just talked about. You can find me. I'm on Twitter at Dr. Asim Malhotra. I'm on Facebook, Asim Malhotra. Instagram, Lifestyle Medicine Doctor. That's probably more than enough for people to know.
Okay, fantastic. Well, I really appreciate your time, and I'll give you a shout when the episode comes out.
All right, mate. Good stuff. Take care. Good chat.
Thanks, Asim. All right, bye-bye.
Thanks for listening, everyone. Please don't forget to jump over to iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts, and hit the subscribe button. And please don't forget to leave a 5-star rating and review to get the podcast in front of more eyes. This podcast is made possible thanks to paleocanteen.co.uk, which is my company. Paleocanteen.co.uk is the UK's one-stop paleo and low-carb food provider, where you can get restaurant-quality meals, grass-fed Scottish beef and lamb, outdoor bred pork, and a selection of paleo and low-carb products delivered chilled to your door. That's paleocanteen.co.uk. Use the code CANTEEN15, that's CANTEEN15, to get 15% off your first order. Thanks, and see you next time.